This recording accompanies the Language B Higher Level Examination, Paper 2, Listening Comprehension, for English, May 2023.
Cet enregistrement accompagne l'examen de Langue B, Niveau supérieur, Épreuve 2, Compréhension orale d'anglais, May 2023.
Esta grabación acompaña el examen de lengua B, nivel superior, prueba 2, comprensión auditiva de inglés, mayo 2023.
The start and end of each audio text will be indicated by this sound.
Le début et la fin de chaque texte audio seront indiqués par ce son.
El inicio y el final de cada texto de audio se indicarán con este sonido.
The end of the examination will be indicated by this sound.
La fin de l'examen sera indiquée par ce son.
El final del examen se indicará con este sonido.
Text A. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear an audio recording from a museum of immigration. In the recording, an immigrant family recounts their stories.
In this museum, you will learn about the many contributions immigrants have made to Canada. In the previous section, we looked at some tasty dishes from around the world. Now, an immigrant family will tell us their story.
My name is Chirag, and I moved to Vancouver from my hometown back in 1946. I would have made a stop in Hong Kong, but back then, immigrants who made a stopover en route to Canada wouldn't be allowed to land. Oh boy, that journey almost killed me. I was not a boat person. I don't even remember how many times I threw up on the boat. Plus, we were only given one small meal a day since the boat was short on food. What truly killed me, though, was how much I wished my parents and my wife were there with me. But in the end, I made it. At the beginning, it was difficult for me to find a job. Many people didn't want to hire me, not because of my skin color, but my different accent, even though English is my mother tongue. So I started to sell traditional food I made myself in the street, and I managed to make ends meet. After a few years, I opened a convenience store with a friend, a tiny but decent one. On top of local products, we sold spices from India. Surprisingly, it was a huge success. Finally, it was 1958 when I could sponsor my family to come here. But they didn't arrive until 2 years later. It was full of hiccups, but they made it. Then my daughter Rhea was born. She's taken our business to a whole new level. Rhea, why don't you show them our family photos and tell them our story?
Sure, Dad. This photo was taken in 1964, and I was still a baby. It was a milestone for us because my dad bought his friend's share and became the sole owner of the convenience store. For two full decades, my mom and dad worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that they could afford private French lessons for me. And I'm forever grateful for how much they've done for me. In 1985, I graduated with a degree in business administration and started to manage the store full-time. 5 years later, I took a huge risk by tearing down the convenience store and founding a supermarket instead. We're thrilled to see how fast it's grown. One thing my parents would always insist on was for me to remember our roots, so we've been visiting their hometown every year in March since I was born, no matter what. For sure, I'll continue this family tradition and never forget our family history.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
In this museum, you will learn about the many contributions immigrants have made to Canada. In the previous section, we looked at some tasty dishes from around the world. Now, an immigrant family will tell us their story.
My name is Chirag, and I moved to Vancouver from my hometown back in 1946. I would have made a stop in Hong Kong, but back then, immigrants who made a stopover en route to Canada wouldn't be allowed to land. Oh boy, that journey almost killed me. I was not a boat person. I don't even remember how many times I threw up on the boat. Plus, we were only given one small meal a day since the boat was short on food. What truly killed me, though, was how much I wished my parents and my wife were there with me. But in the end, I made it. At the beginning, it was difficult for me to find a job. Many people didn't want to hire me, not because of my skin color, but my different accent, even though English is my mother tongue. So I started to sell traditional food I made myself in the street, and I managed to make ends meet. After a few years, I opened a convenience store with a friend, a tiny but decent one. On top of local products, we sold spices from India. Surprisingly, it was a huge success. Finally, it was 1958 when I could sponsor my family to come here. But they didn't arrive until 2 years later. It was full of hiccups, but they made it. Then my daughter Rhea was born. She's taken our business to a whole new level. Rhea, why don't you show them our family photos and tell them our story?
Sure, Dad. This photo was taken in 1964, and I was still a baby. It was a milestone for us because my dad bought his friend's share and became the sole owner of the convenience store. For two full decades, my mom and dad worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that they could afford private French lessons for me, and I'm forever grateful for how much they've done for me. In 1985, I graduated with a degree in business administration and started to manage the store full-time. 5 years later, I took a huge risk by tearing down the convenience store and founding a supermarket instead. We're thrilled to see how fast it's grown. One thing my parents would always insist on was for me to remember our roots, so we've been visiting their hometown every year in March since I was born, no matter what. For sure, I'll continue this family tradition and never forget our family history.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text B. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a conversation between Allie and Stephanie, two staff members of a refugee services center, about ways to engage refugees in the community.
Stephanie, have you looked at the survey results on refugees' engagement? Even those who've been here for a while don't feel they belong here. That's pretty alarming, eh?
It certainly is, Allie. The issue has been unaddressed for way too long, and it's getting out of hand. We must act on it now.
Definitely. I feel language has a lot to do with it. I remember coming here as a refugee, and language was a huge barrier to my integration. I had a hard time socializing with others, so I always felt like a foreigner.
Well, It used to be the major issue, but these days many refugees come here with enough English to at least communicate. I think what's deterring them from social engagement is housing.
Housing?
Yes. With the lack of affordable housing in downtown nowadays, they get pushed to remote suburbs and become socially isolated.
And our poor public transportation system certainly doesn't help.
Tell me about it. It took me 2 hours to get here today. In any case, I noticed that those who share similar backgrounds tend to stay close to one another, which is not a bad thing because they form a close-knit community. On the flip side, though, maybe that has limited their chances to engage with others in the city.
I see where you're coming from. But based on what I heard from refugee families, many wanted to build stronger connections with their refugee neighbors. But it was tough for various reasons. So, the bonding even within their community is in fact lacking.
Perhaps we need to launch another marketing campaign and encourage them to come seek help.
Or, we need to offer more personalized support instead, such as outreach, in order to get to them. You see what I mean?
That's spot on.
It reminds me of a buddy program I used to run in my previous job. It could be something worth considering.
A buddy program?
Yep. Hold on. Let me show you the e-flyer we had before. We called it the Family Buddies Program. The aim was to create a space for locals and newcomers to socialize in family-oriented events. Through these events, the refugees made friends with locals and became familiar with their surroundings. As the name suggests, the family piece was the essence of all program activities. Hence the program mission, as you can see on the flyer.
Interesting. How about the logistics?
We would recruit a volunteer local family and match them with their newcomer counterpart. And then arrange for them to do stuff together every other week. They could do any activity as long as everyone was comfortable with it. We stressed that it had to be interactive in nature, though. However, we didn't allow tutoring as an activity, since they wouldn't get to explore the city.
That makes sense. But how did you make sure people wouldn't bail out after a few times?
We gave out complimentary bus tickets to those who had made a 6-month commitment as rewards.
It sounds like a comprehensive program. Did you organize activities at your center also?
We did. It was a great way for the entire group to come together and mingle. One of our most successful activities was ice cream making. It was so much fun.
Sounds good. Let's do that.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Stephanie, have you looked at the survey results on refugees' engagement? Even those who've been here for a while don't feel they belong here. That's pretty alarming, eh?
It certainly is, Ali. The issue has been unaddressed for way too long, and it's getting out of hand. We must act on it now.
Definitely. I feel language has a lot to do with it. I remember coming here as a refugee, and language was a huge barrier to my integration. I had a hard time socializing with others, so I always felt like a foreigner.
Well, it used to be the major issue, but these days many refugees come here with enough English to at least communicate. I think what's deterring them from social engagement is housing.
Housing?
Yes. With the lack of affordable housing in downtown nowadays, they get pushed to remote suburbs and become socially isolated.
And our poor public transportation system certainly doesn't help.
Tell me about it. It took me 2 hours to get here today. In any case, I noticed that those who share similar backgrounds tend to stay close to one another, which is not a bad thing because they form a close-knit community. On the flip side, though, maybe that has limited their chances to engage with others in the city.
I see where you're coming from. But based on what I heard from refugee families, many wanted to build stronger connections with their refugee neighbors. But it was tough for various reasons. So, the bonding even within their community is in fact lacking.
Perhaps we need to launch another marketing campaign and encourage them to come seek help.
Or, we need to offer more personalized support instead, such as outreach, in order to get to them. You see what I mean?
That's spot on.
It reminds me of a buddy program I used to run in my previous job. It could be something worth considering.
A buddy program?
Yep. Hold on. Let me show you the e-flyer we had before. We called it the Family Buddies Program. The aim was to create a space for locals and newcomers to socialize in family-oriented events. Through these events, the refugees made friends with locals and became familiar with their surroundings. As the name suggests, the family piece was the essence of all program activities, hence the program mission, as you can see on the flyer.
Interesting. How about the logistics?
We would recruit a volunteer local family and match them with their newcomer counterpart, and then arrange for them to do stuff together every other week. They could do any activity as long as everyone was comfortable with it. We stressed that it had to be interactive in nature, though. However, we didn't allow tutoring as an activity, since they wouldn't get to explore the city.
That makes sense. But how did you make sure people wouldn't bail out after a few times?
We gave out complimentary bus tickets to those who had made a 6-month commitment as rewards.
It sounds like a comprehensive program. Did you organize activities at your center also?
We did. It was a great way for the entire group to come together and mingle. One of our most successful activities was ice cream making. It was so much fun.
Sounds good. Let's do that.
You now have 2 minutes, 30 seconds to finish answering the questions. Text C. You now have 4 minutes to read the questions.
You are going to hear a radio interview about high school students' right to free speech.
Good morning, listeners. Some of you may have followed the news about universities withdrawing acceptance offers to candidates who cast some racial slurs online. This has caused many high school seniors to frantically clean up their social media. In fact, one school is taking a controversial approach to watching students' online behavior. We're glad to have the school director, Anna Jahn, today to explore the topic more. Anna, what makes your school feel the need to monitor what students post online?
For their personal development, of course. As educators, we have a responsibility to guide students to behave appropriately, even online.
But they're not on school grounds. In real life, you don't follow students around to check on them, but you do actively monitor what they write online.
That's because we're talking about the school forum.
Okay. So what would be considered inappropriate then?
Obviously, anything that incites hate in any form. For example, let me show you. This parody about a teacher here has to go.
Do you just delete it?
Yes.
What about free speech? It's no different than a satirical comic in the newspaper.
Yes, but free speech should come with some boundaries, and we absolutely do not tolerate disrespect. That kind of attitude causes disruptions to their learning.
But isn't it a form of censorship?
Well, we are not saying that they cannot voice their opinions, but that should be based on respect.
Then what is the standard procedure when the school thinks a student has crossed the line?
In our current policy, our online monitors actively look for problematic posts and delete them when it's mild, like the parody. When something is flagged as severe, our disciplinary team will inform the parents. If it's somewhere in the middle, we typically just meet with the student and encourage them to delete the entry themselves. We do take disciplinary action against students on some of the most severe cases, and unfortunately, that happens more often than we'd like it to.
When it gets to that point, what kind of disciplinary action is taken?
It is all examined on a case-by-case basis. We look at the severity and then determine the form of punishment.
Oh, Anna. We have a caller on the line who wants to ask you some questions.
Hello, both. My daughter tells me that your school gave detention to students who tried to mobilize others online to protest against the expensive school lunches. Isn't that a blatant violation of their freedom of expression?
We do encourage our students to express their voices. At the beginning, students were putting up posters everywhere, and we didn't intervene. Until we found out online that they were discussing ways to purposefully disrupt learning, like blocking the cafeteria, you know, so others cannot buy food. Also, chanting in hallways, that'd be very distracting. They were even thinking about writing graffiti everywhere. We had to nip it in the bud.
So basically, you imposed punishment for their thoughts expressed online instead of their actions offline. This kind of control brings nothing but fear to students. And it is this very feeling that hinders their academic development more than any protest action.
That's a very strong accusation, sir. In any case, I must clarify that in the end, the students were only given a verbal warning, but not detention.
Fine. I just want to make sure the school will safeguard students' freedom of expression.
Thank you both for such an interesting discussion. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back to it.
You now have 2 minutes before you hear the recording for a second and final time.
Good morning, listeners. Some of you may have followed the news about universities withdrawing acceptance offers to candidates who cast some racial slurs online. This has caused many high school seniors to frantically clean up their social media. In fact, one school is taking a controversial approach to watching students' online behavior. We're glad to have the school director, Anna Jan, today to explore the topic more. Anna, what makes your school feel the need to monitor what students post online?
For their personal development, of course. As educators, we have a responsibility to guide students to behave appropriately, even online.
But they're not on school grounds. In real life, you don't follow students around to check on them, but you do actively monitor what they write online.
That's because we're talking about the school forum.
Okay. So what would be considered inappropriate then?
Obviously, anything that incites hate in any form. For example, let me show you. This parody about a teacher here has to go.
Do you just delete it?
Yes.
What about free speech? It's no different than a satirical comic in the newspaper.
Yes, but free speech should come with some boundaries, and we absolutely do not tolerate disrespect. That kind of attitude causes disruptions to their learning.
But isn't it a form of censorship?
Well, we are not saying that they cannot voice their opinions, but that should be based on respect.
Then what is the standard procedure when the school thinks a student has crossed the line?
In our current policy, our online monitors actively look for problematic posts and delete them when it's mild, like the parody. When something is flagged as severe, our disciplinary team will inform the parents. If it's somewhere in the middle, we typically just meet with the student and encourage them to delete the entry themselves. We do take disciplinary action against students on some of the most severe cases, and unfortunately, that happens more often than we'd like it to.
When it gets to that point, what kind of disciplinary action is taken?
It is all examined on a case-by-case basis. We look at the severity and then determine the form of punishment.
Oh, Anna. We have a caller on the line who wants to ask you some questions.
Hello, both. My daughter tells me that your school gave detention to students who tried to mobilize others online to protest against the expensive school lunches. Isn't that a blatant violation of their freedom of expression?
We do encourage our students to express their voices. At the beginning, students were putting up posters everywhere, and we didn't intervene. Until we found out online that they were discussing ways to purposefully disrupt learning, like blocking the cafeteria, you know, so others cannot buy food. Also, chanting in hallways, that'd be very distracting. They were even thinking about writing graffiti everywhere. We had to nip it in the bud.
So basically, you imposed punishment for their thoughts expressed online instead of their actions offline. This kind of control brings nothing but fear to students. And it is this very feeling that hinders their academic development more than any protest action.
That's a very strong accusation, sir. In any case, I must clarify that in the end, the students were only given a verbal warning, but not detention.
Fine. I just want to make sure the school will safeguard students' freedom of expression.
Thank you both for such an interesting discussion. Let's take a quick break and we'll come right back to it.
You now have the rest of the time to finish answering the questions.